Let me say a word or two about this beating around with my hands that you've seen me do during the music. It's not for show. I do something like it when I'm all alone at home, listening to a recording. It's a physical response to sound, quite similar to what a conductor does, with the major difference being that he leads rather than follows. This is why these motions are often called armchair conducting, and I recommend it to you highly. Nobody will bother you, and they will never make a mistake. Music is a physical art, not only an auditory one. The body moves along with the mind. It responds to and it anticipates the musical events. I've never understood how a concert audience can sit perfectly still during Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, which Wagner had called the apotheosis of the dance. I'm glad they do sit still. If they tried to help the conductor, it could be very distracting. I agree. But at home or with friends or in a pre-concert talk, it is a mark of engagement and involvement with the music. Dance and choreography, in a way, does exactly the same, in some free synchronization with the sound of the ballet music. It's not or should not be Mickey Mousing, where everything that happens in sound is immediately echoed in the motion. That's too simple. But it is a way to express sounding motion with physical motion and imaginative recreation. So I remind you that the art of listening is an activity, not a passivity. And the total attention that we pay to a musical work can result in a response of the body as well as the heart and mind. Music has been called spiritual gestures in sound. In fact, with its relationship to speech and the motions that many make with their hands as they speak, you've seen it on the news, it sometimes drives you crazy to see somebody who can't talk without gesturing, but I understand it. It's almost visual to us what happens in sound. Beethoven smiles at us. He growls at us. We can see him chuckle. We can hear him curse. So it's no wonder that our responses often mirror those musical gestures with our own. We spoke of variation as an important device in composition. Now, Beethoven was an exceptional master of it, variation. To him, a theme or an idea was like clay in the hands of a potter, a sculptor. It could be molded and shaped and transformed into any shape he liked. Not only did he write such monumental sets for the piano as the famous Diabelli variations, but he did miraculous and unexpected things with just about all his ideas in the course of developing them, sculpting a large-scale composition. As an example, you all know the great theme of the Ninth Symphony finale. Here's the Cleveland Orchestra with Christoph von Dohnányi. How many of you have ever wondered where Beethoven came up with that crazy and rather vulgar march that introduces the tenor aria later on in the finale? Bass drum. Thank you. Now, it took me about 25 years to notice for the first time that the march theme of the orchestra is nothing else but a variation of the Ode to Joy theme itself. The notes are exactly the same, but the rhythmic shape has totally changed. The mini pianist this time is me. Listen. Again, it's not necessary to know that or to recognize it, but it does provide a look into the composer's workshop. Even if we don't recognize or know of the connection, we somehow feel subconsciously that it is right. We understand that it is not an extraneous idea, that it belongs, that it is an integral part of the whole structure. Unlike Mozart and Schubert, out of whose brains music seemed to stream like a waterfall, Beethoven worked hard at his ideas. When we speak of a work, we are quite on target. Many themes that now appear to us as divinely inspired only came about after a long and difficult labor. For example, this theme of the slow movement of the Fifth Symphony. Luckily for us, Beethoven's sketchbooks have been preserved. And there we find that what first occurred to him was this. Well, that's pretty darn dull, isn't it? It's square, it's uninteresting. So like a potter making a vase, Beethoven takes this piece of clay, squashes it, and starts all over again. The upbeat changes from that commonplace beginning to this. Ah, that's already better. And what was a rather boring continuation suddenly becomes what we know. No. Right. So you see, for Beethoven, inspiration was not always a kiss of the muse, but the end result of hard work. In sculpture, the great model, of course, would be Michelangelo. Donald Tovey, the great British critic, said, "Inspiration is a condition akin to first-rate athletic form." That's nice. Let us turn briefly to the last two sonatas that Dr. Kogan will play for us. Some biographical notes need to be mentioned first. They have to do with Beethoven's love life. Yes, it did exist, and not just incidentally. He fell in love with great regularity, but nothing ever came of his infatuations and affairs. Either the lady in question was already married, and therefore unattainable, you psychoanalysts will understand that, or the lady was at least engaged. Many of them found the young composer fascinating, warm-hearted. Even so, his eccentricities caused them some concern and hesitation. It's very likely that if Beethoven had been able to find a woman willing to care for him sufficiently to watch out for his irregular life, take charge of it, which would have included reasonable nutrition and hygiene, he might have lived much longer. But there was one relationship that promised to come to a real bonding, and that was with a woman of about 30 who genuinely loved him and might even have left her husband and 4 children for him. Beethoven expressed his ardent longing and passion for her while calling her only his immortal beloved in his letters. But even that had to end, not least because the composer could not see his way clear to break up her family, but also because he somehow sensed that if he were married, he would lose perhaps a crucial part of his independence, and with it, his overriding devotion to his art alone. What part the immortal beloved played in calling it off, we do not know. For some 150 years, the identity of that woman was a hotly debated puzzle, until it was finally revealed and documented by Maynard Solomon in his book of 1977. There's a woman by the name of Amélie Brentano. The story he tells, and the extraordinary sleuthing, the incredible sleuthing he undertook is worthy of Sherlock Holmes himself. I do hope you will read about it, along with the rest of his magnificent biography. The other biographical point of importance is Beethoven's attempt to be a father to his nephew, Karl. It is an often heartbreaking story of misunderstandings, lawsuits with the boy's mother, a suicide attempt, and the well-meaning uncle's utter failure to deal with a rebellious teenager. That Karl, in turn, found his growing up with an uncle of such gigantic self-absorption essentially impossible should not surprise us today. This issue is also one that has deep psychological implications, and perhaps Dr. Kogan will have something to say about that. That Beethoven got along very badly with his family might also have been expected. He especially disliked his brother Johann. When that gentleman came to visit him once in Vienna, he left a visiting card that said, neatly embossed, "Johann von Beethoven, landowner." When the composer came to see him a little while later, he left a handmade card saying, "Ludwig von Beethoven, brain owner." Yes, he did have a brain. And his nobility as man and artist was recognized even with all his eccentricities. The van in his name, and that was a question earlier asked of me by one of you, the van was not an indication of aristocracy. In the Netherlands, which included Holland and Flanders and our modern Belgium, van was more of a place name, like Van Gogh, or even Van Eyken, but not like Van Cliburn. Ludwig van Beethoven really meant something like Louis from the beet farm. Beethoven. The composer didn't mind that in Vienna he was often referred to as Herr von Beethoven, which automatically raised him to the ranks of the aristocrats who provided him an income. Beethoven's influence on the music of the 19th century was immense. As I said, the so-called Romantic era really begins with him, and the concentric circles around his achievement expanded exponentially. Schubert, Weber, Berlioz, Schumann, Chopin, and the young Wagner revered and learnt from him. Brahms, born just 6 years after Beethoven's death, always said that he felt the tread of the great master behind him when he was working. Bruckner and Mahler were musically permeated with the spirit of Beethoven. And in the 20th century, we at last became aware and familiar with his total production and lasting impact. Even today, a Beethoven concert or a series is a sellout every time. To us as listeners, Beethoven's work is an integral part of our lives. It's no wonder that the Romantic age, concurrent with and imbued with poetry and fantasy, should begin with musical pieces called Pathétique, Eroica, Moonlight, The Tempest, Prometheus, incidental music to Goethe's Egmont, and Schiller's Ode to Joy. The love of nature, the growing awareness of national history, of legend, as Wagner demonstrated it over and over again, the sense of the fantastique, the poetry of love and passion, all made their mark as the 19th century took shape in the wake of Beethoven and Goethe, Keats and Shelley, Heine and Dumas, Géricault, Delacroix. So when Beethoven writes for us an incredible work called the Appassionata, which Richard Cogan will play for us, we will hear a seminal work of early Romanticism. Impassioned it certainly is, as well as vehement and stressful, written around the time of the Eroica, in the first years of the 19th century, at the time of the Waldstein Sonata, the fourth piano concerto, which is a very different kind of piece. It speaks a language that was new even for Beethoven. Here, says Maynard Solomon, the composer moves irrevocably beyond the boundaries of the high classic piano style, creating sonorities and textures never previously achieved. He stretches the potentialities of both instruments and technique to their outer limit. The dynamics are greatly extended. The colors are fantastic and luxuriant, approaching quasi-orchestral sonorities. The sonata maintains an unusual tragic mood throughout. Unquote. Your pianist here again is Anton Kurti, who many of you remember from his Cleveland days and later from his many recordings made from his base in Toronto, where he's regarded as one of the top Canadian pianists. Here's the beginning of the Appassionata. Expectation, suspense. idea of playing. What wild and truly impassioned stuff this is, just as most of us imagine Beethoven to be. Somebody had the temerity to say to him once, "But Herr Meister, this chord is not permitted." Beethoven said, "I permit it herewith." It's been permitted ever since. Now, I'm sure you noticed that little rhythmic figure, pa-pa-pa-pam, that we know so well from the later Fifth Symphony, and even the Fourth Piano Concerto in a different way. It's like a drive wheel generating motion. It permeates the entire huge structure, and toward the end of the first movement, it is spelled out again in its original form. Actually, this pa-pa-pa-pam is not exactly the one that will appear at the beginning of the Fifth Symphony, which is different in rhythm. It is preceded by an eighth note rest, pa-pa-pa-pam, pa-pa-pa-pam, like this. It becomes sort of the heartbeat of the entire first movement. It's always there, even under other themes. You hear it beating. No, the appassionata one is more related to the ancestor, if you will, of the third movement theme, right on the downbeat, like this. Same idea in different apparitions, like Apollo himself who appears this way and that way, Zeus who appears in a million forms as he makes his conquests of this nymph and that naiad, but remains Zeus. Musicians call this reuse and working out of a rhythmic or melodic fragment, motivic development. And that's exactly what it is, the development of a motive. Now, the slow movement is one of those great hymnic adagios that occur so frequently in Beethoven's work, that kind of suspended time, a devotional expression we will find again much later in the solemn slow movements of Bruckner and Mahler, 70 or 80 years later. And the finale follows without a break. It leads toward a sort of outcry, and then sends us off on a wild and unstoppable ride. Chopin must have loved that and learned much from it. Watch how Chopinesque it becomes. In his annotation to the complete set of Beethoven sonatas that he has recorded, Anton Kurti says this about the Opus 110, which Dr. Kogan will play next for us. He says it is the most accessible and therefore the most popular of the five late sonatas. And what he feels about the closing pages really applies to the whole work. He says its expression is disarmingly warm and open, inviting all hearts to rejoice and resonate with its happy fervor. Here is that warm A-flat major sonority that Beethoven so loved. But soon you have a retrospective look back to an earlier style, the sweet memory of Mozart. Watch. Alberti bass, as it's called. Eighteenth century style. Can you imagine the old man sitting there, not hearing a thing, playing this for himself? It's almost a conversation with himself. Whether anybody listens, that's another story. This is the penultimate work in a set of five late sonatas, which culminates in the sublime Opus 111, which is his 32nd sonata. We say late sonatas, but in the years from 1816 to 1822, he was only in his late 40s to early 50s. The sonata Opus 110 was completed on Christmas Day of 1821. He was so absorbed by his work that, as Dr. Solomon reports, he often failed to appear for meals, and his absent-mindedness increased. He would forget his hat and be seen bareheaded in inclement weather, his long gray hair dripping in the rain. He had become wholly possessed by his art. Well, if you have to be obsessive-compulsive, maybe that's the way to do it. Following the lyrical first movement, we hear a brief and trenchant scherzo with fantastic rhythmic displacements and off accents. An extraordinary close. It's a coda of 15 measures that seems to vanish into thin air. Just disappears. Watch. Like an echo, if you're at Echo Lake. Distant, distant sound. Now the finale, of which we can only play a minute, begins with a 5-minute recitative fantasy of great sentiment. In Anton Kearty's words, it is a song of woe, heavy with sadness. I can't possibly excerpt it. Beethoven's spirit would come down and strike me dead if I tried it. But when the slow music ends, we hear an extensive and expansive fugue on this subject. Thank you. symbolically I'm leaving the musical examples suspended on a dominant seventh chord for you. Now this is really thinking in tones, is what Beethoven called the act of composition. It's also, of course, an homage to Johann Sebastian Bach, whose well-tempered clavier was his constant companion. If Beethoven had written an Art of Fugue, he might have included this movement along with many other extraordinary fugues. He turned to the fugal form at moments of greatest tension. He does it in the third symphony, he does it at a place in the seventh and elsewhere. Interesting, the most condensed, the tightest musical design of them all. In time in this movement, the lamenting arioso comes back, the fugue subject is heard upside down in inversion, alternating, and it's very complex. To do it justice without playing it complete is really impossible. Alban Berg once gave a lecture, a spoken analysis of one of his works, and he said at the end, "Now forget everything I have said and listen to the music." It's good advice. Beethoven's idolized poet Goethe put it this way: "For gray, my friends, is all of theory, and green the golden tree of life." So it is appropriate to end our examples with a tribute to Bach, which proves once again the wonderful continuity of music over the centuries. In his valuable book on the composer, Maynard Solomon often refers to Sigmund Freud. The first of these quotes is this: "Unsatisfied wishes are the driving power behind fantasies. Every separate fantasy contains the fulfillment of a wish and improves on unsatisfactory reality." With the aid of his music, Dr. Solomon writes, Beethoven had wrapped himself into a protective coat of his own daydreams. We seem to be in the presence of a fantasy life of rich and unusual dimensions. As I mentioned to you on September 7th, Professor Solomon would be in town on Friday the 16th to give a lecture at Case Western Reserve University. And so he was. He gave a very original and enlightening talk on the subject Creation Scenarios from Mozart to Schubert. He showed us via numerous examples how the great masters of classical music often suggested in tonal structures the progression from chaos to order, from darkness to light. It was a provocative and absorbing talk, and the great scholar had a large and receptive audience. In the question period, I was one of the inquirers, and we have had a cordial and rewarding correspondence since then. Now, as to questions, do you have any that I might try to grapple with? I know it's late. If you have to leave. If you have any questions, this is the time to speak or forever hold your whatever you want to hold. Yes, ma'am.
What was your question to him?
Oh, I asked him about a place in the Beethoven Symphony, whether that fit his particular thesis, which he answered. And then I gave him some material that I thought would interest him. He answered instantly and wrote some very nice letters. He's a very thoughtful and humane person. So we have become friends through this particular occasion. Do you have any other question? Yes, sir.
I'm not sure exactly how to put this question, but I'm impressed as I listen to you discuss this about his ability to think. Yes, he thinks in terms of tones, as you said, or at least in part, large part. But it seems to me, I've wondered at least, whether he didn't have a remarkable, and this may relate to the fantasy remarks about the fantasy, too, remarkable ability to think.
Not only to think, but he also had a rather surprising response to other stimuli. He often admitted that he often had a picture or a poem in his mind. If he writes a sonata called Les Adieux, the farewell, there may have been a real farewell in his mind. He takes the universal and makes it personal. He takes the personal and makes it universal. This is what great artists do. So his way of thinking, the musical thinking process, is very special that composers have. It's different from the executive artist, executant artist, who interprets or deciphers what the composer had in mind. But this is where you get the great differences in how you look at a piece. But even the composer may have different views of his own piece. I've known recordings by great composers of their own music in which they thoroughly ignore their own markings and do something quite different. It's surprising. So, but their thinking is one of building a musical structure the way you build a music, build a spoken sentence or a written book. And this is very special, and only a very few people can do that and do it consistently. One of the questions that came to us last time on September 7th is very interesting. Beethoven as a composer of vocal music, somebody asked. Well, he wasn't. He was not terribly interested in the voice. He wrote very few songs, and his use of the voice in pieces like the Missa Solemnis and the Beethoven and the Ninth Symphony is almost cruel in its demands. He was not terribly interested. It's like a little bit he said to a fiddler who complained about a difficult passage. He said, "You think I think of your miserable fiddle when the spirit seizes me?" Well, it's one of these poetic. Okay, but he also would say to a singer, "So you do it. Go ahead. Hold your high A and your high B flat for a minute, even though it ruins you for the next day. I need it." And the Ninth Symphony, the Missa Solemnis, would not be the same pieces if they weren't so full of strain, full of effort. If they were smooth and easy to do, he wouldn't have the same kind of piece. Not that he didn't know the voice, he certainly did. Fidelio is full of the most wonderful singing, and so are these other two pieces, but they are terribly demanding. He was an instrumental composer, first of all. And to him, the voice was simply another instrument. That was one of the questions that came up last time. Any other ideas to share? Yes, sir.
Klaus, one of the last quotes that you did implied that Beethoven, in a sense, transmogrified in some way his terrible lot and his unhappiness, and I suppose in the psychoanalytic sense, sublimated.
Correct.
Kind of music.
Yes.
Is it possible to be a happy, great composer?
Yes. Absolutely possible. Beethoven, as Frederick